Because we just came from Mayapur, I was thinking of describing a little bit something that's just makes a connection with a topic from Srimad Bhagavatam. I'll risk it. Go ahead and describe. Something that I heard Srila Prabhupada say on several occasions is the theme of what I'd like to speak about this evening. Prabhupada said that one of the foremost responsibilities of a spiritual master is to thoroughly instruct his disciple about the abject futility of seeking happiness through fruitive activity. I'll say it again because it's again and again. One of the foremost responsibilities of a spiritual master is to thoroughly instruct the disciple about the abject futility, completely useless, to try to find happiness through fruitive activity. Because as long as one is hoping for happiness through fruitive activity, one will not be able to advance spiritually. You know the story, the wedding party, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. This is something that when I was the very first Back to Godhead magazine that I received was 1969. Is that possible? Yeah, 1969. That's a long time ago. It was stapled together, Back to Godhead magazine, and one of the main features in that magazine was an illustrated description of what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur had told or had described during one Vrindavan Parikrama. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur not only during Gaur Purnima time conducted Navadvip Mandal Parikrama, but during Kartik time conducted Vrindavan Parikrama, and for 30 days they went to all the holy places, literally all the holy places in Vrindavan, and then each evening he held a pandal program. And during the question answer session one evening, a devotee asked Bhaktisiddhanta, why is it that we see that one person makes very swift spiritual advancement side by side another person seemingly doing the same kind of rata and the same intensity and the same everything, they don't make spiritual advancement? Why is that? So he answered by telling the wedding party story. And you know the story. Once upon a time, one young man was to marry a young woman, believe it or not. And the culture in India was that on the evening before the wedding, there would be a boat ride down the Ganges, and when the sun rose in the morning, the boat would be at the home or the village where the young lady lived, and they would then begin the wedding from the early morning hour on the auspicious day of the wedding. Oh, everybody got on the boat. Very jolly. Oh, happy day. Tomorrow is the wedding day, and they took rest in the boat. And when they get up in the morning, wedding should begin very soon. We're looking forward. And they looked around and they were in the same place. And they got very angry at the boatman. Boatman, you spoiled everything. You fell asleep. What happened? No, I didn't fall. I was rowing all night long. So how is it we're in the same place if you're rowing all night long, downstream? They searched and he hadn't taken out the anchor. And that's the end of the story. So Bhaktisiddhanta said, similarly, if one does not pull out the anchor of attachment to fruitive activity, seeking happiness through fruitive activity, one will not make spiritual advancement. And another way of saying the same thing, besides it's totally futile to seek happiness through fruitive activity. Prabhupada said the same thing in a different way. A devotee is materially pessimistic and spiritually optimistic. You know what pessimism means? Pessimism means if I throw a ball this way, it's going to fall, it's going to go that way, the other way around. If I jump out the window, I'm going to land up in the sky. That's not going to happen. So, pessimism. It's not very likely this is going to happen. So, materially, pessimistic. Happiness through material life, pessimism. Not going to happen. But happiness through spiritual life, optimistic. I was giving two Sundays ago, I was with Chandramali Swami, and he had the audience repeat after him. I don't know why he did it that way, but I guess to help reinforce people remembering. Spiritual life can be difficult. Material life is impossible. Chant the holy name. So, like the chapter or the section in Nectar Devotion, Hope Against Hope, Asha Bandha, Rupa Goswami writes that even I may feel myself unqualified. He writes that, you know, I'm useless, I'm decrepit, I'm filled with bad qualities. I have no qualification for approaching your lotus feet, my Supreme Lord, but I know that you are very merciful and therefore I have hope even though I'm unqualified. The hope is not our effort. The hope is the quality of mercy of the personality of Godhead, the one who approaches him feelingly, that he won't neglect that person. So, the relevant part from Mayapur is Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya wrote one nice verse that has stood the test of time over some 500 years since the time that he wrote it, that it's maintained the position of being a very much appreciated summary of Lord Chaitanya. Who is Lord Chaitanya and the gift of Lord Chaitanya? Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was an extraordinary scholar. He was, we heard this in Mayapur, he was given a benediction by Yogamaya herself. In Mayapur, her name is Prodhamaya. In Vrindavan, she's known as Purnamasi. Maheshwara Visharadha had two sons. He was very, very prominent, respected, elder Brahmana. He had two sons, Sarvabhauma. Actually, his name was Vasudev, but he later got the title Sarvabhauma. The Sarvabhauma is a title, and the best amongst the learned personalities, Sarvabhauma. And his younger brother Vidyavachaspati. So, of the two brothers, the older brother was very negligent in his studies. Lazy. And his father was strict. And his father, so his father told his mother, his wife, this boy, Vasudev, he's not qualified even to eat rice. You should feed him ashes. He won't do his studies. So the submissive wife didn't want to disobey her husband. When she gave her son his meal, over in the corner was a little pile of ashes, and then there was his rice and vegetables. So when he received the plate from his mother, he asked his mother, "What's that over there in the corner?" She said, "Oh, that's what your father said you should receive for your meal, because you won't do your studies." So he was very hurt by that. And it went deep into his heart, and he left, he didn't eat, he was just upset, and he just was walking and walking and walking and walking, and his mood became very heavy, and he was thinking, "I should just give up my life if my father feels that I'm only fit for eating ashes." And as he was walking along the path, Yogamaya herself appeared before him and said, "Don't do this. It is destined that you will be a great scholar. In fact, I give you this benediction that whatever it is that you read, even once, you'll be able to perfectly remember it." That would be pretty good, right? For doing your homework and taking exams, all you have to do is read something once, and you remember it perfectly. Not bad. Just, at least you have to read it once. So, given that benediction, he became encouraged to do his studies and read a lot. And he remembered everything that he read. So as he grew in years, he became the foremost scholar, not only in Navadvip, but in the whole of India. With one exception. Because in Navadvip, we often hear this, and it's true that in Navadvip there was a center of, not only many Brahmanas lived there, not only was it a sacred place of pilgrimage, but it was a seat of high learning. Many, many Brahmanas came from many different parts of the country to live there and study there, and because it was known, there are six darshans, or six main renderings of the Vedas. And in Navadvip, they were expert in all of them except one. And the one that was missing was Nyaya, logic. But there was a place in Mithila, some distance, long distance away, and they were very expert in Nyaya. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya made a pilgrimage to Mithila and requested the brahmanas there to teach him Nyaya. So then he would be proficient in all six darshans. And brahmanas are supposed to be liberal, but they were a little less than liberal. A little more like Kripana than Brahmana. They were reluctant to teach him, but they had to teach him. So they taught him. Then he asked them for a copy of the book. And they said, no, we're not giving you a copy of the book. We've taught you, but that's it. So he went back to Navadvipa, and because he had this didactic memory, he wrote the whole book. And then he taught. And so he taught all six of the darshans perfectly. And this increased the fame of Navadvipa, but also of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, so much so that the king of Orissa, because then Bengal and Orissa were, the demarcation of boundaries was a little different. And there was still a strong influence of people from Bengal going to Puri and Puri going to take bath in the Ganges. It was a mixing. So King Prataparudra heard of the acclaim of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, and he requested him, please come and become my chief priest for the whole of my kingdom, and you can reside in the holy land of Jagannath Puri. So Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya accepted that offer. This is even before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was born. But while living in Navadvip, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya's age was similar to that of Nilambar Chakravarti. Nilambar Chakravarti was the mother of Sachi, the father of Sachi, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mother. So that tells you how old Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was. It's like his grandfather. So when Lord Chaitanya came to Puri, and he came to, was invited, arrangement was made to take him to the house of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya when he fainted in the Jagannath temple in a swoon of ecstasy and love of God. He Sarvabhauma, then inquired from Gopinath Acharya, his brother-in-law, who is this 24-year-old effulgent, beautiful sannyasi? He's the grandson of Nilambar Chakravarti. Oh, I know Nilambar Chakravarti. This is his grandson. I know Jagannath Mishra. This, I knew he had a son, but here he is. Oh, we're like family. He was very, very happy. And so, he wanted to protect Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as a young, very, very beautiful, attractive sannyasi, to protect his sannyas vows. So he volunteered, I'll teach you Vedanta Sutra. So we'll help you stay strict in your sannyas vows. And Lord Chaitanya said, you're very kind. I'll just sit at your feet and listen. No, you're a sannyasi. I'll sit at your feet, but you listen, and I'll protect your sannyas vows. So 7 days later, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya said, I don't know if you're understanding my teachings, because you don't say anything. You don't make any indication one way or the other of your understanding, so please let me know. Do you understand Vedanta Sutra? And he spoke and said, yes, I understand Vedanta Sutra, but as you're explaining every sentence that you speak, it clouds the meaning more and more. What do you mean? I'm speaking exactly as Shankaracharya taught, the meaning of Vedanta Sutra. If you think you know the meaning of Vedanta Sutra, then you say. And the explanation that Lord Chaitanya gave was so profound. Because Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was super scholar, like not ordinary, super scholar. He was Brihaspati, incarnation of Brihaspati, the priest of the demigods. He was astounded at the explanation. So then he asked Lord Chaitanya, can you explain the Atmaram Sloka? And Lord Chaitanya said, you're a great scholar, I'm sure you can explain the Atmaram Sloka. Oh yes, I can explain. I can give you 13 different meanings. So he gave 13 different meanings. And then Lord Chaitanya was asked to explain Atmaram Sloka and gave 60 different meanings, not repeating any of the 13 that Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya gave. And after hearing, just from hearing, because of his qualification of erudition, just from hearing, he realized, this isn't an ordinary person. This is the personality of Godhead. He had the realization, and he expressed that, and Lord Chaitanya simply smiled. Like an apiary. Different sounds of different birds. Ayo, ayo. They're cute. I was waiting to hear him say it again. Ew. Just from hearing Lord Chaitanya's explanation of Vedanta Sutra and the Atmaram verse, he realized that he was the personality of Godhead, and Lord Chaitanya then showed him his Sadvuj form. Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya fell at his feet, and it was confirmed he's the personality of Godhead. So from that time, Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, who had been an impersonalist, intellectual scholar, he became the greatest of devotees. With all of his vast, vast learning now applied simply to the personality of Godhead, service, Lord Chaitanya's unalloyed service. So he wrote one verse. He wrote a number of verses. He wrote 100 verses in glorification of Lord Chaitanya. Spontaneously in Sanskrit. Wrote them down. And two verses are found in Chaitanya Charitamrita. And one has stood this test of time. Vairagya vidya nija bhakti yoga shikshartam ekam purushak puranam. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Sharira Dhadi. What's the last line? Yas tvam aham prapadye. I surrender unto Sri Krishna Chaitanya, who has given to the world his exquisite teachings of Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga. Bhakti Yoga accompanied with the embellishment or the enhancement, the ornament. The ornament of detachment combined with knowledge. Later, Rupa Goswami changed that term to yukta vairagya rather than vairagya vidya. But it was important in Lord Chaitanya's teaching that not just for sannyasis, because he was a sannyasi, but also his householder disciples, that it was important that they were fixed in detachment from the expectation that happiness will come from fruitive activity. Because without becoming detached from that expectation, you can't make advancement. And I've said it 5 different ways. And the Bhagavatam teaches the same. No surprise. Because Lord Chaitanya's teachings are based on the teachings of Srimad Bhagavatam. So there's many sections, but I'll describe part of one section. The discussion between Narada Muni and King Prachini Bhari comes in the 4th canto of the Bhagavatam. And King Prachini Bhari was in the line of Swayambhuva Manu and Uttanapada. Swayambhuva Manu is the first of the 14 Manus. And he had 2 sons and 3 daughters. The 2 sons, the elder of the 2 sons was Priyavrata. The younger son, so their brothers, was Uttanapada. The elder brother, Priyavrata, he was in line to become the emperor, following Swayambhuva Manu. But he made a request of his father, my younger brother, he's very qualified, and may I have your permission, rather than becoming the emperor, let me go to the forest and just focus on perfecting my life in pure devotion to the personality of Godhead. So Swayambhuva gave that consent. So Uttanapada became king. Uttanapada had 2 wives, Suniti and Suruchi. Suniti was the elder, her son was Dhruva. Suruchi was the younger, her son was Anupam. And the king, Uttanapada, favored the second wife. And that whole description followed, where Dhruva went off to the forest being insulted by his stepmother. Narada gave him instructions how to meet directly Lord Vishnu. He met Lord Vishnu directly, achieved spiritual perfection. He went back and became the emperor. And the line of kings from Dhruva continues on and on. And all of those kings in succession became perfected souls under the guidance of Narada. Until it came down and down and down to the end of the 4th canto, this line of Uttanapada, came Prachini Bhari. And Prachini Bhari wasn't up to the standard of his lineage. He was a very good quality person, but he was too much attached to fruitive activities. So much so, Narada decided, everyone else in the line has been delivered by me. Let me go and visit King Prachini Bhari. And when he came to visit King Prachini Bhari, he was religious. Very properly, he received Narada and all the manners of one of culture and etiquette. So Narada was pleased by that reception, but he could see he's too attached. He can't just directly hear. Very similar to the 6th canto, where King Chitraketu was too attached. He couldn't hear it. Beans in his ears. He was thinking something else. In Chitraketu's case, it was he wanted a son. Overwhelmingly, blindly attached to something that wasn't meant to be, and he had to have a son. And King Prachini Bhari's case, just from one yajna to the next yajna to the next yajna, and a whole band of brahmanas were doing yajnas for the purpose of increasing his prosperity. That was his idea. Dharma, artha, for the purpose of kama, and at some point moksha, maybe. But lots of artha and lots of kama, based upon lots of karmakanda rituals. Too much attached. So Narada understood, I can't just give transcendental knowledge to this person. He's too attached. So what do you do with a person like that? One of the things that one can do is you tell them a story. Because everyone likes stories. So he told them a story. Once upon a time, there was a king. And his name was Puranjana. It's an allegorical story. In the Bhagavatam, the stories almost exclusively are not allegorical. But there are some cases where they're deliberately allegorical. One of those is where Hiranyakashipu was at the funeral of his brother Hiranyaksha. He was trying to pacify Diti, his mother, and the mother of Hiranyaksha, and the family members, the Daitya family members. So he told some allegories to help them understand, to help them become detached. And when one of the allegories was an allegory within an allegory, just to help the family become detached. So this is another specific example. Otherwise, that the stories and the descriptions in the Bhagavatam are history, literal histories. So anyway, he told the story of the king Puranjana, who had a fabulous kingdom with great wealth, and the citizens were all very happy because they were prospering, and they were prospering because King Puranjana was doing many, many karmakanda yajnas. And in other words, he was telling a story about him. Just gave him a different name. But then the difference was, there was something that was missing in Puranjana's life. He didn't have a queen. So he went searching here and there and everywhere for a queen. High, low, this way, that way, and he couldn't find the proper queen. So he was sad. Then one day, off in the distance in a garden, he saw a very beautiful woman playing with a ball, bouncing the ball and moving her bodily limbs in such a way that, whoa, he got attracted to that woman in the park, and he was very forward. He went right up to her and said, who are you? What's your name? What are you doing here in the park? And will you marry me? Didn't waste any time. And she agreed to marry him. And the rest of the whole story, and his becoming attached, and his building a fortress, a big palace with 9 gates, and serpent inside to help guard the gates, and so many things, all allegorical, describing the body, the city of 9 gates, and the life air is the serpent inside. And so he told the whole story, and then how he died thinking of his queen. So in his next life he became a woman, because yam yam vapi smaran bhavam jajatante kalevaram. But fortunately, King Puranjan, in his next life, he had learned a lesson whoops, I was too much attached to material activity. I better be far more careful on the spiritual side. And the woman then became very involved in spiritual activity and went back to Godhead, in short. It's a long description, several chapters. And at the end of those several chapters, King Pajunibari says, "Wow, that was a great story, but I don't get it. Could you explain it? I'm sure there was some message that I was supposed to receive, but I'm too dull. I didn't get it." So Narada explained that the whole section is 375 pages. It's like a huge part of the Bhagavatam. And after giving, you know, the explanation, the queen that he was searching for is material intelligence. Because you can't have happiness in material life without material intelligence. You gotta go out and get a college degree so you can get some material happiness together. Pull this resource and that resource together and make happiness happen. And item by item, each of the characters in the story had something to do with material life. And being attacked by Chandavega, old age. And then came death. And after hearing the whole explanation, the king said, "You know, I think I get it, but I'm not really sure. Could you help me a little bit more?" So Narada gave another allegory, much shorter. He said that there was once a deer, and the deer was in a park, like a garden, and there was, with his female deer, there was flowering trees with various colors and fragrances of the flowers coming from the trees, and bees humming, going from these flowers to those flowers, and soft grasses, and the deer was so enchanted by this nice scene, he didn't even notice that right in front of him was a big tiger, ready to pounce on him and kill him in a moment. And behind him in the backside was a hunter with arrows, and his bow was drawn, ready to fire the arrows and finish him. Then that was the allegory, very short. And he said, similarly, one who's enamored by the seeming comforts of material happiness loses sight of the danger of their circumstance, the peril of even of seemingly nice circumstances before one is time. And the tiger was time. And time takes the life of everyone. But not thinking of the reality of the situation, being so enamored by the happiness of the circumstances, time is going to take one's life. And behind is Yamaraj, Lord of Death. And if one has neglected this human form of life's purpose, then one is destined to be taken to a lower life form, to the agents of Yamaraj. But not knowing the real purpose of life and being very neglectful, thinking about the happiness of the comforts of life, one is attacked from front and behind. And then the king said, "Wow, I think I get it." But one thing is, all the priests that were assisting me, engaging in the Karmakanda rituals, they never told me any of these things. How come they never told me any of these things? Because what you're explaining, it makes so much sense. It's true. Why didn't they tell me these things? Maybe they just wanted to keep their job and keep me engaged in fruitive activity. But I have a doubt And the doubt is, in the story of Paranjana, you described how his activity as the king implicated him in reactions in his next life. And my doubt is this. In one's previous life, one has a body. Listen carefully, it's a little subtle. In one's previous life, one has a body that in the present life, that body is gone. So how can the activities of a body that's now gone bind one to a new body and a new life? I don't understand. Can you please explain? So the answer that Narada gives has both some message of Sankhya and a message of the transmigration of the soul. But it's like Bhagavad Gita 201. It's a little more subtle, so listen carefully. He said it's actually not just the gross body, it's the subtle body that envelops the soul. Because the gross body is perishable. And when the gross body perishes, the subtle body continues from that gross body to the next gross body. So while in the previous gross body, through fruitive activities, the senses are extended into the field of matter, and impressions are made in the subtle body, and those impressions are stored, and they form, in the stored condition, they form desire. Because there was a desire that created the activity, and the impression from the activity then creates a stored desire. And then when the gross body is finished, that stored desire is still there, stored. And the subtle body, based upon the stored collection of desires, the living entity in that subtle body, because of the stored desires, develops a new body. Although the desires are still just stored. They're in a seed-like state. And as the time energy passes, tick, 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 invisibly, the time energy then awakens those desires. And the desires come out. Awakened. And then new, fresh activities in this new, fresh body are performed, again creating more impressions that are then stored. And in this way, the activities of the previous body are binding upon the soul in the present body. And then he went on to explain, just as the gross body that we presently have is generated by the desires that are stored in the subtle body, similarly one can tell something about the condition of one's previous life by the activities of the senses in this life. And he gave the following example. Supposing the condition of the mind is anger. Because the subtle body generates the gross body, if the mind is connected to the hand, and the mind is a state of anger, the hand forms a fist. One doesn't have to think, form a fist. It forms a fist. Maybe you've seen people that get angry. Just they do that. If the mind is connected to the tongue in anger, it speaks something harsh. One doesn't have to think about it. It just comes out. If the mind is connected to the face, or to the leg, then there's kicking. And the face is the index to the mind. And you can see, although you're not seeing the mind, you can see the condition of the mind is anger in the face. And because of that condition of mind, you can tell something about the activities of the gross body in the previous life that formed the impression that made that desire, although stored and dormant for some time until some impetus along with the time energy brought out that desire. His advice, I want to look to see. How do they do that? I was listening to a lecture where Prabhupada was speaking and one child made some sound like that. And Prabhupada stopped and started speaking about children screaming. He said, every living entity has some empowerment. A child has the capacity to scream in such a way, 3 miles away you can hear them. He said, I can't do that. And their body is so small, but they can do that. 3 miles away, they can scream and someone can still hear them. Or something that I've noticed is, not only children can scream, but the parents know whether it's their child or not. Screaming. We were sitting in a big, you know, the temple room in Gita Nagari. And, you know, everything's quiet, normal, and all of a sudden, one child screams. And immediately, the father was over here, the mother was over there, they both stood up and went right to where the child was. All the other parents just sat still because they knew it wasn't their screaming child. They recognized that unique sound vibration. Well, there were two sentences that I wanted to read from the purport here. I didn't look it up, so I won't be able to read it to you, but I'll, it's one of those things where Prabhupada says, therefore, we should understand. It's kind of like you hear those phrases in Prabhupada's purports and it, you know, sits straight because he's giving you the essence of a long, you know, description. The body that we now have is generated from the subtle body, which is based upon material desire. And the solution of that implication in the gross, the package of the subtle body generating the gross body and then creating urges or impetuses for material activity that then further generate more bondage through impressions stored in the subtle body. It's not possible. Well, he didn't elaborate so much. It's not possible through just cessation of activity. You can't stop the bondage by stopping activity. For a number of reasons. The soul is active. You can't stop activity. And the cycle of those activities making their further impressions will not stop. Because it's a perpetual motion machine. It just keeps going. It's the packaging is such, the system is such, it just continues. It's spirit and matter interacting. So the solution that he gives to the king is stop fruit of activity. He points to the palace gate and says you should leave at once. If you can't leave at once, you should at least curtail your fruit of activity and take up devotional activity. Because he's in the presence of Narada, he's very respectful. He was a pious king. Because it was Narada speaking and he had respect for the person speaking, the words went in. It didn't bounce. It went in. He got it. It took a while because he was really attached. But he got it. And he did exactly what Narada had recommended. King Prajinibari left the palace and he went to the forest as his sons had gone, because his sons were the Prachetas. And they achieved spiritual perfection like that because they weren't attached. They received Lord Shiva's mercy, and later they received Lord Vishnu's direct darshan and Narada's association, and they became perfected souls. And they produced, as they had promised their father, they became married and they produced good praja, which was exactly what King Prajinibari had requested, but from the platform of spiritual perfection, not from the platform of fruitive activity and indulgence in pious family life. They were engaged in the consciousness of pure devotion to the personality of Godhead. It's a world of difference. It's the difference between dark and light, day and night. Diametrically opposite positions. Although, from a worldly perspective, they may look the same. They're not at all the same. The difference between the spiritual world and material world. Persons that aren't trained through the process of scriptural training, they don't see the difference between what a life of devotion is and material life. They see families with children and sing song and dance and food and nice life. You're doing the same things we're doing, as far as they can see. Except maybe you're a little strict on your diet and some other things you're strict on. But it's not just behaviors, it's the consciousness behind the activity. It's a world of difference. World of difference. And the total difference in the destination. And there's no implication in this, that which Narada has very thoroughly described to the king. The implication of each activity you do means further bondage. Each activity you do, it's bringing you one step closer to eternal life. Like the verse in the second canto of the Bhagavatam that says, for the life of those who are not engaged in devotion, with each rising and setting of the sun, they're that much closer to death. So one could say, well, that's true for a devotee too. But for a devotee, it's one step closer to eternal life. Provided that we're engaging ourselves in a proper manner in devotional service to the personality of Godhead, whether it's in the forest or it's in family life. Grihe tako vani tako. We're enjoined to be engaged in the chanting of Krishna's holy name and regulating our life according to theistic conduct, codes that are described in the Vedas for what's suitable for our particular psychophysical condition, our ashram and our varna, our occupation. And different for different persons, and that's fine, but the essential thing that's the same is taking shelter of the personality of Godhead. One last and final time, that will not take place as long as we're too much attached to the expectation of finding happiness through fruitive activities, because we'll bring that same mentality into the arena of devotional service, and that's not what devotional service is. Devotional service isn't finding happiness through fruitive activities. That's not what devotional service is. We engage ourselves in different activities in service to Krishna, but it's not in the realm of fruitive activity. It's devotional service. Family life and Krishna consciousness is for the pleasure of Krishna. If we're doing it properly, if we're conducting our duties properly, for the satisfaction of Krishna. It's not cold and impersonal. It's very warm and personal for the satisfaction of Krishna. Each of the things that we do, whatever that is, for the satisfaction of Krishna. And that carries us to Krishna. And those that we're connected with carries them to Krishna also. That's our way of life. So side by side, this chanting of Krishna's holy name that connects us directly with the personality of Godhead and helps make the heart pure. Cheto darpana marjanam. And at the same time, hearing the messages of Srimad Bhagavatam that direct our activity to the path of Krishna. So we know how to regulate what to do, what not to do. We know what is dharma, what is to be done, what is not to be done. The essence is paradharma, satisfying the personality of Godhead. So we're guided by those teachings that tell us this is satisfying, that's not satisfying to the personality of Godhead. So we do certain things and don't do certain things based upon the paradharma principle, what's pleasing to the personality of Godhead. We accept those things that are favorable, anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam. And reject those things that are unfavorable for advancing the happiness of Krishna, the pleasure of Krishna. We're guided by that. And the Srimad Bhagavatam gives us that direction to achieve Krishna's shelter. Okay. Gee, it's 9:15. Any discussion? Or questions? Yes.
So in the beginning you mentioned that Sarvabhuma is a position, is a center. So when we sing the Prema Dhoni, we say Jai Vishnu Pad, Vaishnava Sarvabhuma Shri Jagannath Das Balaji Maharaj, then for Prabhupada we say Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada. So
I don't think the people in the back can hear you, but I'll try to repeat. You're asking the meaning of Sarvabhuma?
Sarvabhuma and Bhakti Vedanta, if you can enlighten what are the finer differences, so to speak.
Yes, it's a title. You know the meaning. Bhakti Vedanta. Veda Anta. The end of all knowledge about Bhakti. Bhakti Vedanta. One who has become so qualified that this individual understands the conclusions of all truths about bhakti. It's Bhakti Vedanta. And Sarvabhauma. Sarvabhauma is a title that Bhaktivinod Thakur gave or began addressing Jagannath Das Babaji. Sarvabhauma Jagannath Das Babaji. Because amongst all the Babajis, he was the preeminent. The Shrestha, the best of all scholars. So Sarvabhauma means that, the best of all scholars amongst the group.
Maharaj, and then we have the Vedanta causes, then after that we have the Sarvabhauma. So is there like one is higher than the other, or because that's the sequence that is there? So that was the reason why I thought to ask.
You can think like that. You can think like that. Prabhupada never entered into that kind of thing, so I can't say much about it. Yes, it's true, he Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vedanta, bhakti vaibhav, bhakti vedanta, and it's like that. So I don't know if that's anything more than Prabhupada wanted to delineate differences, and so he gave different titles. In other words, I don't know if it's part of our Vaishnava tradition that this is higher and that's higher and then that's higher. Rather, my understanding is it's just a distinction. Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhav. There are, say, for the stages of sannyas, they're very clear scriptural stages. Putijak, Bahudak, Parivrajakacharya, Paramahansa, and Paramahansa is the topmost. That's very clear, those delineations. The other one, as far as I know, it's not a standard Vaishnava or Gaudiya Vaishnava. This is higher, that's higher, and that's higher. As far as I know. But if you like to make that distinction, it's okay. So Bhakti Vedanta, Bhakti Siddhanta, Sarvabhauma, which one's higher? They're all higher. And there's some implication or import within the title. That's nice. Bhakti Siddhanta, Bhakti Vedanta, Sarvabhauma. They're all up there. Something else? Okay. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.